I am very pleased to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Alexander Schaus. I first met Dr. Schaus when he was executive director of the APMA. He was very instrumental in getting us started and organized. He is right now, and has been for 15 years, the editor-in-chief of the Medical Journal of the American Institute for Biosocial Research. He is a health publisher for the Journal for Biosocial Research, and he has also published a book, or written a book, called Diet, Crime, and Delinquency. We are very fortunate to have him speaking for us today. Please welcome Dr. Schaus.
Well, for the last 2 or 3 years, I've been somewhat sidetracked with an issue in Washington, D.C., dealing with the dietary supplement industry, and I'm really pleased that that bill has passed. I think that's a tremendous victory for consumers and for the industry, and unfortunately, we're going to have to deal with the agency as it promulgates rules for that bill, but nevertheless, it's a striking defeat for that agency, and hopefully will set the stage for many improvements in health care in this country, as it was the only major health care legislation that was passed by Congress. Over the last 20, 25 years, one of the areas that I have found of particular interest is the whole area of research, and particularly published research, and the whole question of the validity of the studies that we have in our literature. I want to show you a very interesting study that came up in 1972, at a time when I had just finished a couple years earlier leaving the University of New Mexico, where I finished my bachelor's degree. I also ran on the track and cross country and indoor team there, and the team had been undefeated in the nation for the entire 4 years that we were competing. And one of the physiologists at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine was doing a study. And the study involved a new method of training for a group of college athletes. And then he wanted a control group. And so he designed a control group to basically do a sham series of exercises that there was evidence didn't actually produce any physiological benefits. And what happened was that at the end of the study, when they analyzed their data at the School of Medicine, they were stunned to discover that both groups had progressed equally. Now, one of the reasons this occurred is if you carefully look at the literature, and this is something I want to stress over and over and over again this morning, what you'll find is that sunlight has virtually the same effect as exercise for individuals who are out of shape. And so just having the sham exercises outdoors produced more than just the placebo effect, it actually produced the therapeutic effect that was desired. And so, just to show you that sometimes you can assume that the control and the control treatment is a placebo, when in fact it's not a placebo. If you think of the Latin derivative of the word placebo, it means I will please. And it actually connotes that there will be a positive effect. There is also a Latin word called nocebo, which is where you produce a negative effect. And it implies the very fact that the placebo will have a therapeutic effect. And so one of the ironies of doing placebo-controlled trials is that you're actually comparing two therapeutic modalities, and yet most clinicians and the vast majority of the public believe that the placebo is inert and does not cause any therapeutic benefits at all. In other words, that if you put 100 patients through a placebo treatment, you would have zero effect. And that's absolutely not true. In fact, there's some areas, such as in the field of neurology, where you're dealing with migraines and headaches, where you can reasonably expect that anywhere from 28 to as high as 36% of your patients will have a positive response by having less headaches and less migraines, and measurably less and quantifiably less, and perceptively less, and objectively less, and subjectively less. No matter how you look at it, you're going to have less headaches and migraines by the simple introduction of any type of placebo. And so unless you're aware of this phenomenon in that particular subject population, when you compare one agent against another, you're going to come up with some very erroneous conclusions, regardless of the statistical methodology you use. And a beautiful example was a Duke University study from just 3.5 years ago, which purportedly showed that aspartame, which is also known as NutraSweet, when administered to patients, did not produce any adverse effects in the patients by producing any more headaches or migraines. Well, this immediately invoked a tremendous reaction in the neurological community, which sent hundreds of letters to the New England Journal of Medicine saying, well, that's preposterous. And they explained how. And just to prove the point, they later on controlled for that placebo effect and demonstrated that NutraSweet aspartame did, in fact, have benefits. But that's not what appears in the newspapers. And one of the big problems we have today in terms of how the public is getting educated is what is appearing in the newspaper and how that creates public perception. Now, it's oftentimes absolutely remarkable how there can be a body of knowledge, say 200, 300, 400 studies, all of which suggest that phenomena X is true. It's been seen epidemiologically, it's been seen in case control trials, it's been seen in clinical trials, in animals and in humans. And along comes the one study that says this isn't true. That's the one that gets splattered on the front page of USA Today. And I think we saw this very clearly earlier this year with the beta-carotene study in Finland. In fact, this is one country that the World Health Organization has repeatedly advised researchers to avoid because of all of its anomalies. It's a very strange country to do research on, and especially when you start looking at the issues that were being studied in that country, such as cancer and nutrition and the role of antioxidants. Just give yourself some pause in just considering the fact that Finland has virtually one of the lowest selenium levels in the world. So hence, in the water and food supply that's available from that country, you get extraordinarily low levels. And your familiarities as doctors and clinicians and researchers with glutathione peroxidase, you're very familiar with the very important role that selenium plays as an antioxidant and the role it can play in reducing the pathogenesis of many types of diseases, including certain types of cancers. And so you get into these very strange phenomena of seeing in the newspapers articles which never should have shown up, not even in the front page, the back page, or in the comics, simply because of the design of the study. And I want to show you sort of a little history of some examples of the kind of research problems that we have. This occurred at the University of Washington School of Medicine, not very far from where I spend a lot of my hours doing research. And this was a study done at the school in the hopes that they would try to find out, they claim, whether children who are hyperactive respond to certain food additives or to sugar, and they were doing a series of studies. And I was absolutely stunned when I read the preliminary report, which was about to be presented at a national conference and then subsequently submitted for publication. And I thought it was rather strange that they would report this study at a conference before they would submit it for publication. And I'm glad I had a chance to look at it, because I wrote a letter to the principal investigator saying this is maybe one of the most awful studies I've ever seen. And it's really embarrassing. It comes out of one of the top 10 medical schools in the country. Let me just show you what they did. First of all, the study was supposed to be on hyperactive children. And there's a clear definition of hyperkinesis. There's also tests that can be administered to hyperactive children, for which there are 200, 300, 400 references of use, so that you have good validity, reliability, standardization data. But in fact, what they actually selected for their subjects were aggressive, overactive, loud, and noncompliant children. Well, it happens to be that in the field of giftedness, you can actually define many gifted children who have high IQs by exactly that those series of descriptors. And that does not mean that these children are hyperactive. Yet what was interesting is most of these children had been placed on methylphenidine, which is Ritalin, because they were aggressive, overactive, loud, noncompliant. Well, I happen to know one of the researchers there at the school, and they were very familiar with my research. And I said, is there any possibility you could locate any of the parents so I could call them and see if I could see some of those children that were participants in the study? Well, being a psychologist and having at one time being a licensed psychometrist that actually gives tests to people, I I got three of those kids to come to my institute, and I tested them. The average IQ of those three children was 143. Now, I needn't tell you that that's in the top 1% of children for their age. So when you have children that are that, and then I started doing some things after the testing just to get to know the kids a little bit. I had one boy draw a picture, and I literally was watching Galileo in action, the way he was writing and drawing things. And I said, what happens when you show this to your teacher? And you know what this boy said? And he started crying. He said, she throws my pictures away. And you should have seen what this child was describing. It was, you know, something worthy of an advanced course in quantum mechanics. So I thought it was kind of interesting the way they went about the subject selection, which is one of the great weaknesses. And we'll have some wonderful opportunities to illustrate that. So in fact, none of the children in this study, as I looked over the data, had attention deficit disorder, hyperkinesis, or were defined even broadly as hyperkinetic. Parents define the children as difficult to manage, easily distracted, or not doing well in school. The easily distracted could easily be due to iron deficiency, for example, which is fairly pervasive in many children in this country, in many areas of the country, because it affects the left hemisphere of the brain, and that affects cognitive functions, and that can affect distractibility. Difficult to manage, there's so many reasons why that could occur. I mean, the children could be physically abused, all the way to just children that are difficult to manage because they have so much energy. There's so many, I think, plausible hypotheses as to why these children are the way they are, other than that they need medication to control their central nervous system. And children may not be doing well in school for many, many reasons. There's so much in the literature. In fact, it's rich with examples of individuals who did very poorly at many grade levels and then excelled the rest of their life. So this is no reason to medicate children. And yet you realize in this country we have over 1 million children who go to school each day, and they will on Monday, on methylphenidate. And this is an obscene situation in this country to allow this many children to be drugged when we always have known so little about the long-term side effects. And now that the long-term or longitudinal studies are appearing, it's becoming very evident the problems that we're having with these children in terms of alcohol and drug use and other asocial types of behaviors. And look at the way they did the study. This is even more fascinating. In phase one, the children were evaluated before and after a slush. And the slush, as you see, contains sucrose, honey, tapioca, or aspartame after a free lunch of sugar. Now, the study obviously is going to look to see whether aspartame or sucrose creates disorders in hyperactive children. We've already pointed out none of the children are hyperactive, so let's see what's going on. First of all, look at the measures that they're using. An octometer reading. There is absolutely no literature known in the world, because they certainly couldn't provide it to me, that octometers, which are little like wristwatches that measure movement, have ever been demonstrated to measure aggressive, overactive, loud, noncompliant children. The strong Brock classroom observation code, first of all, I had to really look that one up. I'd never heard of it, nor when I called the Department of Psychology there at the school, had anybody there, some of them who've been there 23 years in the school teaching the classes on the subject of how to measure, had ever heard of this test. So this is extremely obscure test. And I eventually found it. They did show it to me. And again, the problem is that the strong Brook did not measure the kind of behavior that they were studying. The number of toys touched during observation play. I guess the assumption is that children who touch toys more frequently than other children have more problems, because that's about the only conclusion that I could come up with. It just made absolutely no sense why you include it in a study. I would think children who would play with toys more often would be more inquisitive and, you know, show some evidence of higher intelligence. Child skill in completing maze drawing. Again, no evidence that children who are aggressive, overactive, loud, and or compliant, that there is any relationship to their maze drawing. There's no literature. And then late reaction report by parents. Now, this was an astounding one. And I asked them, were they familiar with the research of Dr. Joseph Edgar at the London University School of Medicine at the University of Munich? Because I had spent 1985, the summer at Oxford, and had a chance with Dr. Edgar to lecture at the Department of Pediatrics at John Radcliffe Hospital. And we were there to lecture on the field of nutrition and behavior. And I remember explicitly how they had just, and they were very excited about this, discovered that the average onset of a reaction in a child to a food additive and or foods combined when the chemical was producing a central nervous system reaction was 2.3 days after the child was provoked or challenged with the substance. Now, think about this. This clearly suggests that this is a delayed reaction. Certainly wouldn't be an IgE reaction. And so what you would have here is a situation where researchers might plausibly believe that we gave the child the substance, say, at 9 o'clock in the morning on Monday. Now, the child was under our keen observation. We had cameras on the child and observers on the child through two-way mirrors all the way till 5 p.m., and we never saw the child act up. Then on Wednesday, the parents call up and say, my kid's up on the ceiling. Well, wouldn't you conclude that it's the parents who are the problem rather than the agent that was challenged on Monday? If you didn't look in the literature and discover that there's this paper in The Lancet that was published in 1985, and this study was conducted a few years later, so it was clearly possible that had they done a literature search on that particular problem, they would have uncovered this delayed onset reaction. Now, in tribute to Dr. Pauling, who unfortunately passed away this year, it had a remarkable effect on my own career. I remember my first of six books, which came out in 1978, and the very kind things that he put on the cover in his signature when I wrote Orthomolecular Molecular Treatment of Criminal Offenders, was a rather remarkable event back some years ago. We were up in San Francisco at a conference, and Dr. Pauling came to this meeting, and so did Dr. Cameron, and at that time they had just released the study in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that Dr. Pauling's vitamin C theories as related to colon cancer didn't hold any validity based on a study that was done by Dr. Mortel at the Mayo Clinic. Now, I just want to point out to you exactly what it was that Dr. Pauling published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences back in 1976 and then again in 78. Dr. Pauling and Dr. Cameron placed cancer patients on 10 grams of ascorbate for the rest of their life. Their study found that this extended the lives of terminal cancer patients fourfold to an average of 210 days compared with matched controls 50 days receiving conventional treatment. Also, patients reported improvements in appetite, decrease in pain, and some patients were still alive, they had not died, and remained on vitamin C or were slowly weaned down to slightly lower dosages. The weakness, of course, in Dr. Pauling and Dr. Cameron's report was it was a prospective, non-randomized, non-controlled trial. However, the two groups were matched retrospectively based on their hospital records. So it's a relatively weak study. But what you would expect the Mayo Clinic to do is to look at the kinds of patients they had and particularly study the duration of treatment. Now, what you'll see here is something very odd, and I've picked this up many times. In fact, once again in a major study that just appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I got my usual letter, even after the researchers admitted that they were that I was right, that the study probably should not have been published given the research that I had sent them. And the editor and the chief, of course, usually their answer is, we don't have room for your letter to the editor, you know. So what happens is this stays in the literature without being challenged, and it guides clinicians, it guides researchers, and the worst part of all, it impresses upon students what they believe is true or not true about science. You see in this study, which was done by the Mayo Clinic, I mean, the key thing, I don't want to go through all of the weaknesses of the study, but the key thing is that in Cameron's group, Pauling's group, what they had pointed out is that the mortality rate was much, much better as a result of the high intake of vitamin C. And one of the reasons why is because they just kept giving them vitamin C. And in the Mayo Clinic study, they, for some reason, in trying to replicate Cameron and Pauling's work, just stopped the study. And one of the worst things, as some of you are familiar in doing this, is when you put people on 10 grams of vitamin C a day that have an advanced case of cancer, and then you just quit giving them vitamin C. Now, the question is, I mean, was that even an ethical thing to do? And what immediate contribution did that have to mortality rate? But these kinds of issues, which were presented by many people in their letters, which they were kind enough to send to my office, never got published in any literature. And so I remember Dr. Pauling and how upset he was because there were a number of agreements with the Mayo Clinic, and the most important one was that before they submitted their paper to the New England Journal of Medicine, that he would have at least 2 weeks' time prior to submission to respond to the letter, to look it over, to the research paper. And they never gave him that opportunity. And what happened is he got a phone call from a journalist who asked him how he felt about the study, which was coming out in Thursday's New England Journal of Medicine, and it was Tuesday. And I already had my issue the day before. As I'm editor-in-chief of another journal, I tend to get their journal a little bit earlier, and I had already read the study, and I started critiquing it because I couldn't believe the results. And then fortunately on Friday night I had to give a presentation in San Francisco, and there they were. So my point is that these kinds of studies, which of course made front page news because they discredited Dr. Pauling's theories, is what the public and clinicians and researchers believed was to be true. And no one gives any attention to the letters to the editor which appear a few months later, which will critique these kinds of studies and show their glaring and oftentimes fatal weaknesses. But you know what's reassuring, and you want to remember this all your life, is that the truth always wins in the end, always does. And as long as we are human beings, we can have confidence that the truth will always win. Because, for example, you can make all the claims you want about how perfectly round the world is, and you and I know it's not actually perfectly round. But however, it's intellectually dishonest to say it's flat. And in time, you know that people will find out it is, in fact, much more round than it is flat. So as long as you believe that you're on to, you know, what is working for your patients, it's extremely important to persevere, in spite of the fact that sometimes you can find mounting scientific evidence that the results you're getting are wrong, you see. And one of the wonderful things, just to point this out to you, this is the October 18th, 1994 issue of USA Today. And here you have, you know, a big banner right on the front page saying, if you believe in the antioxidant power of vitamin C, one dose a day may not be enough, a new study suggests. So they're actually now encouraging you to take it twice a day. I mean, this is a paradigm shift of where we were 10 or 15 years ago, where we had people claiming that anyone who was taking vitamin C was making expensive urine, that it had no therapeutic effect. They didn't even talk about words such as antioxidants. Nobody talked about free radical pathology. They thought that was something that went on at Berkeley University. You know, so things have changed, and of course, truth will win out in the long run. Let me show you just another example. Some of you have dabbled in the field of clinical ecology or environmental medicine. And this is one of the ripest examples that I used to use in a class a few years ago, just to illustrate every mistake that can be made in research. And how things like this get published is really, truly remarkable, because I'll show you what the typical peer review guidelines are for journals. And when you consider what a good research peer reviewer should be able to do and what gets published, there's something very political going on in the literature. And that's something that we can also talk about. The American Academy of Allergy does not question that foods may cause symptoms, even behavioral symptoms. Official criticism is directed at what they refer to as controversial techniques, such as sublingual or subcutaneous provocative food testing or neutralization procedures. To be considered scientific, they claim, experiments must be reported so they can be replicated. Procedures must be explicitly and unambiguously reported, like tell me something about the nature of the subjects, the identity source of the allergen that was used, the dosages that were administered, the identity of the placebo, the nature and definition of outcomes. So what I decided to do was take a look at this huge amount of literature that was sent to me by a critic of clinical ecology in the Midwest, a very prominent doctor at a medical school. And he contended that based on all of these studies, it's very clear that anyone who gets anywhere near clinical ecology is committing a major gross fraud against the American public. And so I went through each of these studies, and here's some, and I just want to point out, these were all the studies that he sent me. The first three studies I looked at, the subject population was a mystery. We knew nothing about them, not their age, not their gender. The identity of placebo was totally unknown, so we have no idea what the placebo was. The dilutions of the antigens were not described. They do not report what allergens were used. The response parameters were unspecified or arbitrary. One of the funniest ones of all was they had actually, in one of the studies, described what the parameters were. In other words, the reaction might be that the patient said that they got a headache. Well, that meant something happened. And there were three patients who, at the time that they were exposed to something that they were obviously reacting to, fell off the chair. They developed lightheadedness and just fell off their chair. And because that wasn't one of the criteria within the study, they reported that as no reaction. So the another one that's really fun is the placebo changed during the experiment without any explanation. And there's a remarkable example of attrition of subjects. And let me just show you a little bit these studies because they really illustrate the problems we have.
This is the end of the recording on Side A.
This was Brenneman's study in the Annals of Allergy in 1974. Here you see, they claim that the investigators were allergists, but 3 of 10 were familiar with the sublingual method, so that only 3 had any kind of training or exposure to how to do it. The other 7 were basically just trying it out for the first time. Number 2, the double-blind crossover. There was no crossover design, even though it was claimed in the abstract it was. They tested 100 patients, but only 78 were actually tested. Okay? So that's 78% were actually tested. This is real easy math, isn't it? And 61 records were used in the reports. Only 61% of the patients' records were actually shown in the study. There was no explanation for the attrition. I mean, it could have been that all the people were tested and 23 or 30 of them had, you know, severe adverse reactions, but we don't know because there's no such data. And there's no letters to the editor challenging this paper, asking any questions about what happened to these patients. The placebo is poorly camouflaged and not tested for phenolic compounds. The extracts were too diluted. They used an improper, they didn't even use a randomization sequence of any nature at all. There was no randomization in the study. And they concluded, this is in the conclusion of the abstract, that 1,400 tests were performed on 78 patients, which would have been 18 per patient. Well, this gets real funny because in 1973, the 1,400 tests that were administered were added, just added, cumulatively, to a new paper in 1974 that tested another group of patients and gave them 240 patients. So here's what they say. In the new paper, in the same journal, the year following, the 1970 report says, throughout this 2-year period, approximately 1,500 tests were made. The total should say 1,640, because if my math is right, I'm sure you went to the same school, got the same education you did, 1,400 and 240 is 1,640, but of course they came up with 1,500. They must round to the nearest 500s. But 85% of the tests were from the flawed 1978 study, see? Remember that study, which lost the unexplained number of people? So now, in the new study, 360 tests were required. However, they only performed 240 tests on 20 patients. So they lost 1/3 of the tests. They guess they got misfiled or something, you know. There must have been a problem with the computer or something. The investigators were allergists. Only one was known this time. They reduced the number of allergists that were familiar with sublingual treatments. And then 2/3 of the patients had consistent responses to challenge on both the first and second trial. In other words, they did react to the subject that they were, the substance they were claiming they were reacting to, or that the physician thought that they were reacting to. But the conclusion of the study is that, quote, sublingual tests could not be recommended as either reliable or sensitive as a diagnostic indicator of food allergy. And this was being used by the Academy as a definitive example of double-blind placebo-controlled trials, large subject populations done by trained board-certified immunologists challenging this type of treatment. And just to show you some other kinds of things that they do, the protocol was for 12 patients. Remember they said in that first study there were 18 patients and there were 61 patients. Well, look, again, it's a whole mathematics problem. 61 patients were reported. They said they did 732 tests, which would be well, remember, there's 12 tests per patient. 12 times 61 is 732. But see, they said that they did 1,400 tests. So where is the 668 tests that they didn't report? You see, and it's right there. I mean, it's not hidden. It's not like you got to write a letter to them and they got to send you a computer printout and you have to find it that way. It's right in the paper. And you got to ask yourself, why would a paper like this get published? It is utterly flawed. I've handed this to medical students in teaching classes in biostatistics and epidemiology, and they're stunned by these papers. They think that if this was done by some undergraduate student that hasn't got a basic understanding of mathematics, certainly no knowledge of statistics, no understanding of how to develop research protocol, and they're shocked to discover that this is published in peer-reviewed medical journals. Take this one. This was Learman's study. This is 1980. Okay, now they've had 6 years to learn how to do this. Remember, 1973 to 1974, 6 more years of training to try to do this right. Now here it is again, Annals of Allergy. 15 patients is what they reported, they tested. However, they provided 13 that were tested twice. What happened to the other two? The data was collected over 9 years. Now folks, I have a little problem here. Why does it take 9 years to test 15 or 13 patients? Because we don't know which one to believe now. 9 years to find. And you remember, you're a board-certified immunologist. You're an allergist. People come in there with complaints of allergy. And in 9 years, they got 15 patients for this study. However, only three were over 13 years of age. And one patient that was born, now this is true, right in the paper, born in 1970, was tested in 1978, and reportedly had symptoms for 13 years. Okay? That's a dead giveaway that you got to look at that data. Okay? So we're missing 5 years here. The placebo was used of either saline or distilled water. And both Randolph and McGovern had noted that placebos can cause reactions consistently due to contamination, and environmental inhalants needed to be controlled. Here's another example. Test for placebo in 4 foods. The 4 foods were egg, corn, milk, and yeast. Of course, that's cow's milk. Of 60 pairs of trials, 51 or 85% were consistent. And yet they write, quote, "We relied predominantly upon observed changes in the degree of swelling and edema of the nasal mucosa, which he found changed continuously. Nevertheless, even though 85% of the patients showed reactions to these four, one of these four or all these 4 foods, they rejected the sublingual method due to 2 positive responses to the placebo. No report on any other changes, and there were some very other interesting adverse changes that were reported and in the article, and most were too young to know what to report because of their age. So even the source of the subjects in terms of getting reliable data was another flaw in the study. Most of you are very familiar with aspartame. It's a dipeptide that's composed of aspartic acid and phenylalanine with a methyl donor. And one of the things that I just want to point out to you, up in Canada years ago, they were the first in the world to approve using this sweetener. And I was sitting taking a class, and this one neurologist there in the group had said, "You know, Alex, we've seen a lot of reactions up here in Canada from patients in our practice and similar practices who are consuming a great deal of aspartame." And what I asked him to do was just to describe the literature for me. And when this occurred, I called a friend up at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, and I said, "Have you ever had even one case of someone reacting to aspartame?" He says, "Well, it's curious you call, Alex, because we're preparing a paper for the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition." That's where we sent the paper. And in fact, it did appear the very following year. And look at what the report is. And I want to show you this because this is going to help us to understand one of the great controversies that were reported this year in the New England Journal of Medicine that made all the front page newspapers and was discussed worldwide and on all the television shows. You'll see that the CDC characterized reactions of patients that had complained of NutraSweet or aspartame reactions as either being of neurological, behavioral, gastrointestinal, allergic, or menstrual nature. And then they divided these 4 categories into the percentage of reactions that were occurring with each of these categories. So that you see, for example, that childhood hyperactivity was included in category 1 under neurological, as was headaches, mood alterations, insomnia, dizziness, fatigue, visual impairment, and numbness. And the, and there would be similar symptoms in all of this. This is for the tape, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 43, page 464, 1986. Well, a couple of years later in the Journal of Applied Nutrition, even a larger database of 551 patients appeared. And as you see, once again, now the list of symptomatology almost affects every organ and system in the human body. And so this provoked me to even do something on an annual basis, and that is to call the Food and Drug Administration and ask them how many patients this year or American citizens have complained of aspartame reactions. And I was amazed to discover that by last year, more people had reacted and reported their reactions to aspartame than any other substance that the agency monitors. There were over 6,700 reported cases. And this is extraordinary, you know, when you consider the battle that they were engaged in the last 2 to 3 years in claiming that vitamins and herbs were harming the American public, and yet something that they had approved and were responsible for regulating with thousands of complaints was permitted to be in the supply without any warning to the American public. And I want to also point out to you that in this article here under the eye, they report 14 cases of blindness in one or both eyes. I mean, so you're getting into some rather serious reactions that are being claimed as related to aspartame. Now, the reason why this is so important is if you take a look at the controversy dealing with behavioral disorders, sucrose, table sugar, you get into some very interesting ways of now analyzing the data, realizing that there is a body of evidence that suggests that individuals who take aspartame can be quote-unquote hyperactive. And you will see here Prince's study in 1980 from the University of South Carolina. They showed evidence that sugar did cause adverse effects in some children. Bahar's study and Woolridge's study did not show these effects, but notice what they used, a placebo that was aspartame. In Egger's study, which Egger did something very brilliant that if you're not familiar, you should all know this. And I remember when Edgar shared this with me, he speaks German and I speak German too, so we were chatting in German. And I said, my God, that's incredible news. You've got to explain that in English to the people here at Oxford. And he went ahead and described it in graphic detail. They took about 100 children to find out which of the children did actually react to sugar. And they did it under very elegant double-blind design. And what he eventually discovered was that in some of those children, he could not provoke the reaction consistently. So he was trying to find out what were the provocative combinations of maybe foods or other food additives. And he came up with this bright idea of just checking to see whether it was beet sugar or cane sugar they were reacting to. So he took 9 children, and in 9 children, 5 reacted to cane sugar but not to beet sugar, and 4 reacted to beet sugar, not to cane sugar. And when he looked at back at his original data and the sources of the sugar they were using in their studies, that explained why sometimes the children did or did not react. And that just shows you how complicated this research becomes, because if you give a group of children who just by statistical quirk are beet sugar reactors, and you now challenge them with cane sugar at a medical setting using very elegant designs and good statistical methodology, you may come up with a totally false conclusion, which would mislead tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of clinicians, both in the medical sciences and in the behavioral sciences. Hence the reason why it's always so important to read that literature, to become immersed in it, to understand it, to look at all of it, and not just what appears in Medline, but to look at the more esoteric journals as well, because that's where the creative geniuses of many people are being expressed as they're struggling to try to get their provocative, paradigm-shifting studies into the literature. And you see further after Egger's study, which demonstrated sugar, that you get Ferguson's study where they used aspartame, and again they got no differences, right? No statistical differences between the sucrose and the aspartame. Connor's study controlled for that. He found it was sugar. And Goldwyn's study, which was quite interesting because he used Equal, which is 4% aspartame and 96% lactose. they found, again, evidence that sugar affects it. So if you actually look at approximately 6 years of reports, which contended there was a great controversy about whether sugar affected children's behavior adversely, what you will actually see is a pattern that whenever aspartame is not used as a placebo, the evidence suggests that sugar did cause an adverse effect in some children. And so what happens in 1994 is this article appears in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this was on February 3rd, and it says, the effects of diets high in sucrose or aspartame on the behavior and cognitive performance of children. Now, I remember contacting someone here in San Diego who I've admired for many, many years, and that's Dr. Bernard Rimlin, who is a PhD, he's a research psychologist, came out of the U.S. Navy, and he's head of the Institute for Child Behavior Research that deals with autism and severe childhood behavior. When this paper came out, that, and I received it on Monday, and as I indicated, this always is released to the public on Thursday, I called him and I said, you know, let me fax this paper to you, and let's take a look at what the problem is, because I'm stunned by the conclusions. And we were sitting there reading it, and we were coming up with, you know, real esoteric explanations for why this outcome was what it was. And then one little glaring comment, and I want to just show you how craftily they confounded this study's outcome. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. My hat off to them. This one was really good. According, let me read this to you also for the benefit of the tape, because this is a real insult to all of us. According to newspapers and the media, this study funded by NIH and the National Institute for Child Research and Nutrition Foundation has settled the debate on the relationship between sugar, aspartame, and hyperactivity by saying there's no relationship. The New England Journal of Medicine's editorial by Marcel Kinsborn stated, quote, sugar clearly does not induce psychopathology where there was none before, but it may on occasion aggravate an existing behavioral disorder, unquote. A double-blind controlled trial with two groups of children who were 25 normal preschool children, 3 to 5 years old, and 23 school-age children, 6 to 10 years of age. Now the subjects were given 32 milligrams plus or minus 8.9 milligrams of aspartame per kilogram of weight. 1 milligram of ascorbic acid per milligram of aspartame was added to food sweetened with aspartame. Now, you got to stop right there, because that's the key right there as to what's wrong with the study. You don't even need to go on. You got to ask yourself, what is the reason when you have a study that is looking at cognitive performance in students, in children, that you would add a milligram of ascorbic acid to each milligram of aspartame? Well, I did some calculations, and it came out that almost on average, a child was getting about 600 milligrams of vitamin C per day. Now, you ask yourself, what does the vitamin C do that might influence cognitive function in these two groups of children that are receiving, remember, a sweetener, as long as it's sweetened, right? And that's what we're checking, different types of sweeteners out. And to do this study, you have to give children what you think the active agent is and the placebo. And as I pointed out when we began, placebos by their nature produce a therapeutic effect, right? That's the whole definition of a placebo, the Latin derivative, I will please, will produce a positive effect. You see, as many of you should know, the vitamin C, the ascorbic acid, has a reducing effect and actually enhances non-heme iron absorption. Now, non-heme iron absorption can go up 6 to 10-fold what it normally is without the presence of vitamin C. And as a result, you get a measurable improvement in cognitive functioning because you affect directly left hemisphere of the brain. And when you look at the measures that were used later on in the study, you discover that they directly measure the very things that you would ordinarily measure in a study where you're measuring the effects of a study that deals with iron repletion therapy. So you have here children whose iron status is being raised in both groups. That's totally confounding these results, and no wonder they got no differences in the two groups. I mean, what we're saying here, this is a rather sophisticated analysis of a study to find its confounding problems. And this was not something that you would ordinarily expect, maybe even a person with a master's degree in science that's a journalist, and that might be reviewing these kinds of papers and preparing them for Associated Press to be knowledgeable about. This is someone who's got to be fairly well immersed in the literature and know some of the work that's come out of Johns Hopkins and Syracuse University and State University of New York downstate, which have reported for many years these effects of iron on cognitive function. So there are many other problems with the study, and I don't want to get into it, but I just want to show you that that's just a classic example of the difficulty that gets in there. Oat bran, you might recall, a few years ago was also the subject of a study in the New England Journal of Medicine. This one was really quite interesting. It was very widely publicized by Boston University, and there's your site, 1990, volume 147, page 22, that it claimed that its data showed that oat bran had no more effect than a low-fiber diet in lowering cholesterol levels. Now, the result, by the way, of this study on Quaker oats that year was a loss of almost $40 million in sales of their product, because the public concluded that it didn't matter how much fiber you had in your diet, or whether you had Cheerios or Quaker oats or cornflakes or what, or nothing for breakfast, it would have no effect on your cholesterol levels. But the truth of it is, if you look at the study, how could this study by Sachs have come to an opposite conclusion that 11 other previously published studies had shown? Should the baby then be thrown out with the bathwater? In Sachs' study, it was uncontrolled because the researchers had no control over the subject's diet or supplement intake. Of the 20 subjects, 16 were dietitians or dietetic interns that were aged 23 to 49, whose mean cholesterol level was 186 milligrams per deciliter. None were hypercholesteremic. All were healthy and premenopausal. The study was not conducted on in a metabolic ward. So what we really see this study saying, right, isn't that it does not lower cholesterol, that it does not affect the cholesterol levels of individuals who have normal cholesterol to begin with. That could be a rather reassuring discovery, that you're not going to become hypocholesteremic as a result of taking in oat bran or oats as a food source for fiber. But that's not what the newspapers reported. They reported that these products had no benefits in lowering cholesterol levels. And yet, as you know, all the studies previously had been done on males. They had all shown in hypercholesteremic subjects, which various types of hyperlipidemias, that cholesterol levels were lowered with this type of dietary intake. And so I show you here some examples of studies from LSU, and one here from the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, one from the University of Kentucky that was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that existed in the literature that clearly illustrated its benefits. But again, the truth always wins out, because here's a recent Associated Press: oat bran can cut cholesterol, analysts find. So you see, now after some 24 studies, they conclude that the preponderance of evidence is clearly in the right direction. And people are starting to eat oat bran, and Quaker oat sales are starting to go up. And in fact, Quaker oats is making enough money that they're acquiring other companies again, which they weren't. The last one, maybe just to show you an example also of a very common hypothesis about testosterone and antisocial behavior in humans. Again, here the problem is that you focus in on one without focusing on something else that may provide a more plausible explanation of the phenomena of your study. And just to get right to the chase, for time's sake, although this study is commendable, that was done and appeared in the Archives of General Psychiatry, 1971, volume 26, page 479. For its size, it neglects to examine cortisol levels. In 1971, Kreutz and colleagues found that the lower levels of testosterone found in the population was associated with higher levels of cortisol. Other studies have shown elevated cortisol levels associated with withdrawal in animals and inhibition and shyness in humans. Both cortisol and testosterone concentrations should be measured in criminal populations under conditions of social stress. In subjects with a history of antisocial behavior, it may be possible that the authors were observing a deficiency of cortisol rather than an elevated concentration of testosterone, since cortisol can suppress testosterone. Further research on the testosterone antisocial behavior hypothesis is certainly warranted, but this is not what people believe. They still believe, and I've asked this of many individuals in that area, that testosterone is responsible for aggression in humans, and especially antisocial behavior. And I've asked them, what about the cortisol levels? And they said, cortisol, I've never heard of that. So I see, this is where when we start relying on literature by just looking at a study or looking at the front page of the USA Today, we get into real, real serious problems in understanding really where the research is taking us. And what I'll do, I understand, have a workshop this afternoon. I'll show you actually the kinds of steps that one should go through, the kind of literature that can be created to support a lot of what you do here in your particular practices. So with that, I thank you. This is